I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Don't make the mistake of thinking that you've got Patricia Williams figured out just because you read what she writes. In her regular column in The Nation, she describes herself as a mad law professor. When computer pop-ups ask her, she pretends to be a 26-year-old Mormon from Missouri just to mess up the marketers. In her new book, she talks about the roller coaster genealogy of her ancestors, which has left her today, in her words, both a politically correct feminazi black single mother and a soft-spoken 50-something mush of a minority. Patricia Williams' book is called Open House, of Family, Friends, Food, Piano Lessons, and the Search for a Room of My Own. Her search begins late in the 1800s with grandparents and great-aunts from places like Bolivar, Tennessee and Gresham, South Carolina, and it brings us today to the life of an upper-middle-class African-American in New York City. Wound through the branches of the Williams family tree are questions, and that's where we'd like to have you join us. How much has really changed in the way that we regard gender and race? African Americans hold better jobs, make more money, and occupy senior political and corporate offices. But how much are those the measures of success? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Patricia Williams is also a professor of law at Columbia University, and as I said, columnist for The Nation magazine. She's joining us from NPR's New York studio. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You've written for so long about race and gender issues, more often using a lawyer's pen. I wonder if it was fun doing this, writing about your family.
It was great fun. It wrapped me in a kind of warmth. It was the nostalgia in the best sense. I did this as my parents have been aging, and my father in particular has been fairly sick. And this was a way of placing myself in at one of those moments of life where mortality sort of intrudes upon your consciousness.
Can you tell us about your great aunt Mary? You describe her in the book as the daughter of a woman born into slavery and the granddaughter of a white man who raped his 12-year-old slave, but she turns that around pretty well in her life.
Well, she's the one in our family often referred to as the character. And she was the eldest of my grandmother's sisters by quite a few years. And she had been taken from her family when she was only five by the descendants of the family who owned my mother's family. There was a daughter in that white family who moved to St. Louis in order to get married, and she was lonely. And so that family demanded that one of the half-children by the slave come and keep her company.
What would she have been then, Patricia? Would she have been a servant or a house slave?
She was a servant. It was after slavery. It was after emancipation by some years. She was a companion. I think that's the official term for her, the way in which my family remembers it. She was a companion, but she was certainly the little servant girl in the family. She was returned the moment she hit puberty, around the age of 12 or 13. And when she rejoined the family, I think that she had a great sense of distance from it. She had not seen them in that entire time. And she was better educated than most everybody because she had been sitting with the white child's tutor, whom she was supposed to be the companion to. And I think she was the person who really brought the rest of the family to Boston. She was sitting in the outhouse one day, which is what I talk about in the book, and she took from the magazine hung on the hook for other purposes a sheet of a magazine and saw an advertisement for Garland Junior College scholarships for Indian princesses. And that's how she turned her life around. She passed as an Indian princess, came to Boston, married relatively well. That is to say, she married an African-American realtor in Cambridge, and through that was able to bring her other five sisters north to Boston at the turn of the last century. And that's how my family came to be here.
In her second marriage, she marries a white man. Now, at that point, is she passing herself off as a white woman?
Yes. By the second marriage, she had divorced her first husband, or he had divorced her. And she was supporting herself by doing a sort of a Sarah Bernhardt-style declamations, theater, drawing room theater. And she was riding a train one day, and she had decided not to ride in any place less than the club car, which means that she stepped over the color line in doing so. And while passing herself off as white for those purposes, met a woman whose son had been recently widowed. And she ended up being unstintingly sympathetic under those circumstances. The woman introduced her to her son. They were married. And that man was a sort of Boston Brahmin. She passed herself off as white for approximately 20 years during the course of that marriage until his death.
And when the family looks at Great Aunt Mary, is she seen as someone who lost her identity, who created a new one? I mean, you describe a life of inspired deception. How's it seen now?
I think very much the same. I think that my Aunt Mary was somebody whose identity was complicated. If she lost her identity, it was at the age of 5, when, as a very young child with an identity still forming, was taken into a household where she was always of the lower classes, where she was always a member of a subservient caste, where she must have been confused, must put it kindly. She was, in addition to the white tutor whom I mentioned, she was also sent to an Indian school for a while, the so-called Indian boarding schools, where she went as a day student for some period of time. So I think that her identity was complicated by all of the sort of tragic repercussions of race, class, ethnicity in the United States. She was at the vortex of all of those.
It's interesting, though, because what she did in bringing her sisters up to Boston was, it seems, you tell me if I'm getting this wrong, that she created either an expectation or a level of expectation where her sisters and your mother would get this great education. That was almost a given for the Ross family, right?
It was a given even before that, I think. And I think that her peculiar spunk, despite her particular kinds of complications, personality complications, came from her father. Her father was a French-Canadian who came down and married my great-grandmother. And he was very concerned for the fate of his daughters. He had 6 daughters and 2 sons. The sons remained in Tennessee, but he always wanted them to be educated. The other sisters had gone to Rust University even before they came to Boston. Rust University was one of the early schools for African-Americans. And it was the place where Ida B. Wells, the great anti-lynching advocate, also attended.
This was in Mississippi.
It's curious,
actually, to go back there and think, what were those days like? How hopeful were the people about what that education might be? I wonder if there was a sort of post-emancipation, yeah, we can do this.
Well, I think there was a sense of post-emancipation investment in education as being, because education in so many of the southern states had been outright outlawed for African Americans. At the same time, there was certainly availability of education followed to some extent the caste system that began during slavery. That is to say, it was most available for the children of the slave masters, sort of those whom, I guess, Essie Mae Washington, Strom Thurmond's recently discovered daughter, that class,
right.
Just as he gave, in packets of cash, money for her education. That's a tradition that goes all the way back, at least a century. And so some of these schools were founded and funded by Northern missionaries, by Howard University, by acts of Congress in the wake of emancipation. Others were actually set up by former slave masters who wanted to benefit their slave children, their half-white children. So it was an act of complicated condescension. At the same time, somebody like Ida B. Wells really thought that the future of African-American liberation lay in the North, and she advocated migration to the North as the way out. And certainly my great-aunts and grandmother, I think, ascribed to that kind of philosophy that leaving the South was the best way forward, and particularly for the women.
I wonder if you look at that and the context that you can today and say that was the right choice. You tell a story about growing up in your own working class neighborhood in Boston, mm-hmm. pretty well the only black kids in the neighborhood, and it doesn't sound like it's a whole lot easier for you.
Oh, I think it was easier. I think it was the right choice. I think that the particular descriptions I have in the book have to do with the moment when the neighborhood was transformed by a very concerted act of blockbusting.
Right.
It was the era of white flight from many northern cities, and I think it was, you know, it had, with all of its tragic consequences, I saw it up close and personal as the children of people my mother had grown up with described excitedly their plans to flee the colored people. It was literally like Chicken Little. The coloreds are coming, the coloreds are coming. I watched the very first family move up from Mississippi and move into our neighborhood and watched the panic and the hatred rise. And that, I think, is what I was describing there. But in terms of my life's course, I am very glad they came and settled where they did.
1-800-423-8255. Patricia Williams is my guest. This hour we're talking about her new book, Open House. And interested in hearing from you, does the history of race and gender in your own family mark similarities from the past to today? We'd like to have you join us. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. You may know Patricia Williams best from her column in The Nation magazine, Diary of a Mad Law Professor. She's written a number of books. Her most recent one is a very personal book. It's called Open House: Of Family, Food, Piano Lessons, and the Search for a Room of My Own. Patricia's joining us this hour from a studio in New York City. And we were just shifting to your own life. I wonder if I can ask you to read a short section from the book. It's a scene when you've just left an art installation in Soho. It's called A Woman's Work Is Never Done, this collection of, well, sort of found and donated items. Would that be a good way of describing
it? Yes.
And it certainly gets your memory working.
Yes. Yes, I come out onto the street in Soho, and I wondered what had happened to those letters from my first boyfriend and my lucky chain made of juicy fruit gum wrappers and my Beatles cards. For years, I kept a stash of Beatles cards and fan magazines hidden under my mattress. I had a crush on Paul McCartney, which embarrassed me terribly. I was the colored kid in an all-white class and knew well where the line was. In fourth grade, I'd made the mistake of telling an indiscreet friend that I liked a boy best known in that class as the Italian kid. And he was repulsed by my affection, and the other children used it to make cruel fun of him. And so I learned early that having a crush on white idols was not something one confessed to easily or at all. I wondered what had become of the industrial-sized compact of original Max Factor pancake makeup I had borrowed, well, sneaked from my great-aunt's dresser and forgotten to return. It was an unnatural undertaker's orange kind of color, and she used it generously. Foundation, she called it, in tones that implied all Rome rested thereupon. It came in round, oily cakes, the size and heft of fruitcakes, and when my miserable adolescent visage erupted in the glowing, pustular protuberances that won me the nickname Headlights, that tub of foundation was the only thing I could see being up to the job. And I slathered it on thick as bricks, a wall behind which I hid to make it through the day. Years later, when Kermit the Frog sang his lonely little anthem, "It's Not Easy Being Green," I wept, remembering that it also wasn't easy being orange.
Patricia Williams reading from her new book, Open House. This is personal stuff. It's not often that you get into this. I don't know whether or not I'm enjoying it because I'm a voyeur or enjoying it because I get that kind of insight. When I read the passage the first time, I did the same thing that you did. I went off into memories of Beatle cards and things like that.
Yeah.
Those.
Yeah, well,
go ahead.
Go on. I was going to say, my role model growing up was Irma Bombeck, and I think there are other writers who are quite personal about the tortures of being a certain age in a certain place and composing one's face for the world. So I think maybe it's just a little personal for a law professor, perhaps, but who I am.
There's another scene in the book which is quite strong that I just wanted to ask you to comment on, and that is the time mm-hmm. when, as a law professor, you were invited to England to speak in those very highfalutin BBC lectures. I'm not sure how that pronounced them. The Reith? Reith lectures?
The Reith lectures.
Reith,
the Reith
lectures.
Lectures, yes. Lord Reith was the founder of the BBC. Yeah.
You and, got really torn up by the newspapers then.
I did. I was, as I called Lonnie Guinier from London and said, "Help, I'm being Lonnie Guiniered." And it's still somewhat interesting to me why I became the focus of such enormous media attention. I was pictured in every major newspaper in England and more than a few of the tabloids. And I was attacked as a militant black feminist who hates all white people and thinks the family is bad. I mean, it was ridiculous tabloid stuff. And I think part of it has to do with the British press is a little bit like the New York Post. It engages in sensation for sensation's sake. But I also think it was part of I had been invited as part of the European Union's year dedicated to the eradication of racism, sexism, and xenophobia, ironically enough. And I think part of it was because I was an American. Part of it, I think, had to do with sexism itself. I was only the third or fourth woman who'd ever been asked to do these lectures in 50 years of its history. Part of it, I think, was a general tabloid attack on the BBC, which, as you may or may not know, is
favorite target,
undergoing
yeah.
some of the same kinds of attacks that perhaps NPR is in terms of its competition with other more commercial stations and being too, quote, politically correct. And I think the part that was hardest for me was that I think that the attack came from a number of conservative American think tanks who weren't quite certain what kind of international impression I would make. And that was the hardest to take.
But the language, Patricia, was beyond anything that you would see in the newspapers in America, talking about this lecturer of slave stock. That you wouldn't see that in the Post. You wouldn't see it anywhere.
No. It really, no. The over-the-topness of it. I was interviewed by one reporter for one of the broadsheets, who asked me if I didn't think that black men's sexual organs were larger than white men's. You wouldn't get that in the United States in these bold terms in this time. And it's interesting because today one sees a picture on the front page of certain newspapers of Prince Harry dressed with Nazi uniform. Mm-hmm. And I do think there is within the British tradition a kind of posturing, having a flaunting. I mean, if you recall, he was attending a party of colonialism and nativism that I think also occurs to some extent here in the United States, but it's more, we categorize it as frat boy stuff. But I do think it's part of the class system here. It's coded as class. It is racist, but it's also coded as class. A friend of mine said that they would never have done this to you if they had viewed you as upper class. And so, for example, if I were the daughter of a Nigerian prince, I might have had an easier time of it.
See, it's when
I
got
coded.
It's when I got to that part in the book that I stopped and thought to myself, I wonder what Patricia's telling me about, the hurdles and the circumstances that Great Aunt Mary and Grandmother Ross mm-hmm. faced in their lives, and the fact that decades later, some of this same language, some of these same hurdles mm-hmm. are put up for someone in our generation.
I think that the history of slavery, with its history of extraordinary violence, of sexual violence, of beatings, of lynchings, creates intergenerational trauma. We hold our fear inside, even when we're not the direct victims of it. And that's a kind of emotional memory that reinvents itself. And so, although you asked me earlier, am I glad to have... I think that, yes, my mother is two generations away from living from the violence of my great-great-grandmother, my great-grandmother's legacy in that small town of Bolivar, Tennessee. My father, on the other hand, migrated north during the Army, and he held much more of his fear closer to the surface. I think that we as a nation, generally, some of that fear, some of that trauma has migrated north to reinvent itself as the problem of inner cities. Mm-hmm. I think that the prison population, how we deal with prisoners, the fact that in one generation blacks were perceived as clowns, another generation were perceived more as criminals, the question of whether we're perceived as smart or not, flip-flops almost every 20 years, you know, with the Harlem Renaissance, and then we're suddenly stupid again, and then there's the reinvention of the Richard Wright era, and then we're Black Power. Now it's the era of public intellectuals, but I think we're sliding back into a time in the wake of attacks on affirmative action as being just too stupid to be part of a certain class. So I think that that it's repercussive, it laps back and forth. The punitiveness and the prejudice resides in hybridizes itself in different components of our society as we've become more demographically complicated. But it's still something we have to get a handle on.
And it exists within the black community too. I'm thinking back to that exchange of letters and articles that you wrote about Condoleezza Rice and where she fits. You know, is she this black homo figure that sits on the mantelpiece of a Republican administration, or is she a sharp, bright, intelligent black woman who's made political choices that just happen to be different from yours?
I don't think I called her a homo figure.
No, you didn't. I
do think that she represents certainly in the public position of her when President Bush introduced her as the new Secretary of State, he described her roots in Birmingham, and he placed her iconically next to the four little girls who were killed in the bombing of the church there. He placed her squarely within the Martin Luther King tradition, which I commented upon as being quite complicated, given that that Martin Luther King tradition was one of pacifism. It was one of Gandhian resistance, and she becomes, indeed, now the public face of a doctrine of preemptive warfare and a kind of aggressiveness that I am quite certain Martin Luther King would have found himself very much on the opposite side of. So that's what I mean by these sort of hybridized, racialized representations in the world. It's complex.
And if we use her the way that she is seen, or the place that she occupies in American mm-hmm. racial or political consciousness now, and compare mm-hmm. that to you sitting on much further to the left, mm-hmm. would we have this same conversation if we were talking about two white women of a similar age, tracing them back to a different part in the history? Or is that what you mean by saying that you can't really step that far away from the mothers and the fathers who grew up in a time of having ancestors who were part of the slave tradition?
Well, I think that the lesson of, I mean, I'm not sure what you mean, would we be having exactly the same conversation of two women, but I do think that the way in which Condoleezza Rice has been discussed has been one of her providing diversity. And it's certainly not ideologically diverse. She does not provide ideological diversity to this administration. Mm-hmm. She is as conservative as anybody there. I think that iconically, she plays again this complicated role in which 92% of African Americans in this country voted Democratic. I think another 6% are farther left yet. And then another 2 or 3% are conservatives in the model of Condoleezza Rice or Clarence Thomas or whatever. And again, this is not about condemning them for their conservatism. But I do think the way in which sometimes it gets spun is to say that anybody who criticizes them is insisting that they be Democrats. I'm not. I mean, I have the same critique of Condoleezza Rice that I do of George Bush. And the fact that I don't like Condoleezza Rice is not because she is a betrayer of the race. But I am concerned in which the image that because or that her image as a black person means that I should be less critical of her somehow. And I think that's the complexity of how her representation and how her actual politics play against one another.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Patricia Williams is with us this hour. How do you mark the progress, the change, the perspective of race and gender as we're tracing it through Patricia Williams' family history and in a larger term in America? Let's go to Houston, Texas, because Danielle's called in from there. Hi, Danielle. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask Mrs. Williams about, I grew up in New York, and I lived in Boston for 5 years, and I wanted to ask her about her perspective of the light-skin, dark-skin issue in the black community in Boston. I didn't really experience it growing up in New York City, but when I lived in Boston, I kind of got a feeling that there might be a divide there. And from a historical perspective and a personal perspective, I wanted to get her opinion on it.
Yeah, I think that there's, within many black communities, there is this question of so-called colorism, of the Jack and Jill phenomenon. There, for those who may not be familiar with this, a long history of informal social networks or social clubs that bestowed certain kinds of privilege that were networks for jobs and for that actually imitated, and I mentioned that in the book to some extent, the question of cotillions that imitated white society to a distressingly anxious extent. And in fact, my family was not part of that, my direct family. And again, my Aunt Mary came closest to that, but she passed actually from, sort of a servant class black status directly into an upper-class white cotillion society. But none of my family was ever members of Jack and Jill, but certainly that exists, and it was certainly part of black society in Boston. My family personally was on the fringe of it, but I do remember at one point there was a cotillion in Boston, to which I was not invited, but you could follow it in the black newspapers. And it was called, of all ironically, the Snowball Cotillion. It is the source of great division. It is, you know, there used to be things like paper bag tests that I think have been that may be somewhat closer to the popular consciousness, in which at one point in time, people would not be admitted to these parties unless you were lighter than the color of a paper bag, that sort of thing. They're shameful parts of the black history, and I think that that color consciousness probably still remains in some parts. The Black Power movement was as much a response to that kind of division within black society as it was to the larger civil rights struggle.
Let me go back to Danielle in Houston. Danielle, how long have you been in Texas?
I moved here 2 years ago.
How are color and race seen there as opposed to the way that you understood them and saw them in Boston and New York?
I think in New York, I didn't really experiencing it, being a dark-skinned black woman. In Boston, I didn't firsthand experience it, and it seemed like from what I was I'm a physician, and while I was training in Boston, I kind of got the impression from talking to certain people that it existed in Boston, but it wasn't obvious to me. In Houston, it is a little bit more obvious to me. I think a lot of it spill over from Louisiana. There are a lot of transplants from Louisiana to Houston, mm-hmm. and I think it's a lot more obvious to me in Houston.
Patricia makes the point in her book, Danielle, that the doctor that comes ahead of somebody's name can be an important kind of social pass, a key. It worked, Patricia, I think, for your grandfather on your father's side. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I mean, it was I was speaking specifically of my grandfather's, who was very dark skinned and whose mother was African and lived in Savannah during the times of Jim Crow in its most brutal period. And in addition to the kind of colorism that attended social division, there was also a kind of pass for those who were, quote, the good Negroes, who had a relative degree of education, who would, even though he was a doctor, would come in and try to smooth out social arguments because he was more educated and white people felt like they could talk to him.
We need to stop you right there for just half a second. We're going to take a break. Danielle, thanks for your call. A reminder to our callers, Patricia Williams is our guest. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. A chance to take a look at race and color in family and put it into a larger context. We'd like to hear from you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Patricia Williams is a professor of law at Columbia University who likes to write. Her books include The Alchemy of Race and Rights, The Rooster's Egg, Seeing a Colorblind Future. Her new book is called Open House, of Family, Food, Piano Lessons, and the Search for a Room of My Own. She's with us from a studio in New York. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. We're going next to Louisville, Kentucky, and Tony's on the line. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
Yes, my name is Tony, and I'm from a civil rights family from Tennessee. And one of the things that I learned as, you know, growing up this way, is about integration. And integration has come a mighty, mighty long way, but I still think we oversimplified in terms of black and white. I think the great divide, the future divide, is really more of economics. As, you know, as you say, as I'm able to send my kids to private schools or the quote-unquote better quality schools, so on and so forth, that's going to be the great divide of the future. Do you feel that racism, you know, I know it still plays a part in things, but do you feel like it's starting to take a back seat to the economic process and the availability of black folks and everybody else to play in this melting pot now, as opposed to just be separate slices of the pie? Hopefully I said it okay, but anyway.
That's pretty clear. Patricia.
All right.
Yeah, I think economics is going to be a very, very important social dividing point for everybody, black and white. I unfortunately think, however, that race is still a cipher for economic division. I live in New York City, where fully 50%, one half of all black men ages 18 to 65, which is the entire working age population, is unemployed. Maybe that's just economics, but where the disproportion between the rate of unemployment in black populations and the rate of unemployment in white populations is that great, I think we cannot write off racism as a continuing problem. I think that it's also interesting to look at statistics, for example, like Hispanic populations who are recent immigrants, and the degree to which levels of success, in other words, regardless of culture, can be predicted based upon whether those populations divide up according to black or white, even populations within the same cultural group, like Dominican. If you're lighter skinned, you tend to do much better economically than if you're darker skinned. So I think that those are important social signals that racism is very far from an inactive problem.
And you make the point in your book, though, that even at the upper middle class level and living in New York, this is something that you and your son see on a fairly regular basis, where you're identified first by color, not by profession or by virtue of the fact, I guess, that your son is in classes where he's perhaps one of or the only black kid there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that from a very early age, I mean, that the children around him are aware of cultural differences. Children are. Children are perhaps more uncensored about their sense, as opposed to teachers who say, oh, it makes no difference or it's invisible. It isn't invisible. And even sometimes in a very positive sense or funny sense, as I think my son has been in wonderful classes with wonderful children, by and large. But the ways in which it has come to light, even in the most privileged of settings, makes one aware that this is not something which is about to go away overnight.
Let's take another call. This one's from Columbia, South Carolina. Corey's on the line. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Corey. Hi, how are you?
Fine. You be Corey, I'll be Dick for this conversation, okay?
Okay. I just wanted to say I've lived in a lot of different places, grew up in South Carolina, lived in New York, Boston, California, Santa Cruz, and I always felt that I needed to leave South Carolina to get away from small-minded, racist ideas, and I lived in New York, and I saw some of the worst racism there that I've ever seen.
Like what, Corey? Give me an example of what you're talking about.
A bartender friend of mine, we went to see him one afternoon, two black women came in. He totally refused to serve them, and there were only four of us in the place, including them, and he just would not even acknowledge their presence there. This was at Rockaway Beach, and it was horrific. I could not believe it, and then I met a young lady that I invited to come down to see me at University of South Carolina on her spring break, And she was black, and she said no, she couldn't, because she would get lynched if she went down below the Mason-Dixon line. And when I lived in California, I found out that unfortunately, racism, you know, isn't a particular color out there. It's towards the Asians and the Hispanics. But of course, being from South Carolina, everybody assumed that I was racist, stupid, and inbred from where I was. And I just wanted to say that. Unfortunately, it is still out there, but I think that it is, and also I think economically, like the author said, I think that's even a bigger problem.
You're saying it's out there, but it's not talked about, Corey?
Oh, in California, yeah. They think, when we lived in Santa Cruz, which is a very diverse area, they think that they're above it, but they're not. Because, for example, we would have friends that would say, oh, well, we can't buy a house in Watsonville because it's too Hispanic there. And then they would look at me and think that I, you know, because of where I was from, label me that way. And the labeling was very frustrating because I didn't grow up that way. And, you know, anyway, so I just thought that was very interesting to see. And they couldn't see that.
Part of what you're saying, Corey, about the way that racism is, in fact, including more than just black and white. Patricia, I don't know whether or not you share that, that same perspective that she's describing.
I think it certainly is more than black and white. I also think that when it comes to the housing market, I mean, that's where you really scrape. You don't have to scrape very far beneath the surface to see that it is still very much a black and white issue. And again, this division between white Hispanics, black Hispanics, acceptable, the sort of buffer minorities, Asian Americans, and so forth. And these play out in interesting ways, but they play out in much the way that the old Louisiana hierarchy did of very light-skinned on the top and very dark-skinned on the bottom, and then the sort of pseudo-whites or almost blacks or somebody in between, sort of aspirational, about to go on other side of it. And I think that that's something we really have to look at, because we have an enormously, wonderfully diasporic and colorful country. It is this sort of stew of people, but after a generation or two here, people tend to identify as black or white. And we have a lot of work to do. I think that it's only 2% of white people in this country have a black neighbor or a neighbor who's identified as of African descent.
We did a program not long ago.
We have to work on.
I think Skip Gates was here talking about one of his projects that took him into the neighborhoods just outside Atlanta, where he said there is where you go to find upper middle class blacks, and the neighborhoods are all black. Economic success makes no difference. Mm-hmm. The colors remain separate.
Yeah, and even though we talk about colorblindness, the other most openly segregated place, the caller mentioned bars, is the dating scene. I mean, in the back of any personalist column, it's all about separating out by race. There are very few that don't indicate strong preferences for white or Asian, or don't state, you know, straight white male, that sort of thing. But it's part of the cliche even.
As a matter of fact, there's a part in the book where you're talking about my best white friend, and you use the short form MBWF. And I turned to people in the office and I said, "You guys know what this one is?" And MBW, I'm going, black female's probably the end of it, but I'm anyway. I sort of stumbled on that, but I get the point.
I was playing with that. Yeah.
Okay, caught me. Let's go to Durham, North Carolina, for a call. Melva's joining us from there. Hi, Melva.
Oh, good morning to both of you.
Thank you for calling. What are you thinking?
Thank you. I just wanted to give the accolades to Patricia. I read her book over the holidays, and it was a wonderful read from cover to cover. I laughed. I cried. I felt your pain, and I rejoiced in your accomplishments. And I just encourage everyone who's listening to read her book. I am actually going to start reading The Rooster's Eggs next.
Thank you.
And work my way back.
Can I ask you?
Yeah.
Melva, let me ask you, if I can, what it is about the personal insight, the opportunity to kind of go back with Patricia to look at her childhood and you know, questions that she's mulling over raising her son, those sorts of things that draw you into the story. Because I had the same reaction, but
it's refreshing. She's the first author that I've encountered who operates under full disclosure. some of the issues she covered. are issues that a lot of us, I am a black female, choose to keep to ourselves, keep very close to our chest, or share with one dear girlfriend. And the fact that Patricia was so brave in talking about the race relation issues with her aunts and her grandmother, and dealing with issues about being invited to a dinner and being placed under a magnifying glass, and how you felt it was a little unfair, you know, that some of the guests intentionally set you up for that. And I just think it's just really refreshing to read someone's memoirs that is sharing their life experiences with the world.
That dinner party that Melva's talking about, I was curious to know, in your own reflection back on it, this is a dinner party where the host decides to take you on as a public intellectual and put you in your place. Do you think that you were set up for that?
I do. Again, I was. I knew that I was being invited because the host had a friend who was a conservative media figure, and so I was invited to. I guess to liven up the dinner party, but I guess I had gone with the idea that it would be a sort of, you know,
diverse.
respectful. Yeah, yeah. And I did become, you know, sort of the guess who's coming to dinner.
2 years later, you're right. I'm still coming up with snappy answers for that evening with retorts.
Yes,
little bird.
I wasn't prepared. I wasn't prepared for how difficult it would be, and that I would be the only there, and that it would be quite the degree of mockery that it would
that
I encountered.
Yeah. Melva, thanks for that. Let's go next to Boston. Michelle's joining us. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I have two boys, and when they were younger, it didn't matter as much that they were, you know, children of color. But now, for instance, my younger son, who's in middle school, it's affecting him a lot more, even where he's in a, let's say, an all-white or mostly white school district, and he's being affected more so by it now. He recognizes it by himself now. And also, I think it's an issue within the black community. You know, you still look at, well, who's lighter than who? Who's got the best grade of hair? I think it's color is definitely an issue in Massachusetts as well as the country and the world.
What can you do about that, Michelle? I mean, do you talk a lot with the boys about it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I talk to them about their heritage and, you know, the things that they have to be very proud of and work on their self-esteem, and that it's really due to ignorance that the other children or the things that their parents or whoever may be educating them, it's due to ignorance that they're being, you know, exposed to these kind of behaviors. It is also a shame that, you know, you don't see until Martin Luther King Day comes around, or Black History Month, which, you know, it should be all of us all the time, where people start to talk about the issue of color in the United States. It should be an ongoing dialogue, not one that only happens to come around when there's a special holiday.
Patricia, you write about a conversation you had with your son when he's quizzing you about the color of family members. You know, grandma's white. No, she's not. And,
right.
You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, when he was much younger. I mean, my son is also in middle school, and I feel the anxiety as well. I mean, I think that I mentioned the anxiety about having daughters in the black community during Reconstruction, but I think that today's anxiety is clearly focused on you know, when your son emerges as a young black male. And I was talking to a group of friends, and none of us will let our sons ride on the subway alone until they're 32, we've decided. And
what,
I think there
why?
Is this... Well, because I think the perception of men is one of fear. People are afraid of them, and we as parents are afraid that they're going to get hassled by police or hassled by other kids or arrested and just for who they are, or just questioned. We want to protect them from that confrontation of who they are, though obviously they cannot be. I talk to my son as well. My son has had a good life, however, generally. I mean, he's not been badly treated, although he's been in white environments. But at the same time, with a nation which is in love with hip hop right now, when the white kids hit, you know, imitate hip hop, it's one kind of posturing. And when my son wants to wear his back cap and baggy jeans, he becomes far too authentic and far too frightening. And it's a much more complex thing. And people, you know, sort of turn to him as the authority among his classmates for that kind of
show me how to do that move.
Show me how to do it. And you know, what has he learned? He's learned it from his friends or from Eminem or from it's a very American story. But it's also, I think, a dead end for him, where it's a sort of game for some of his classmates, and I think that that's
yeah, I agree completely. I think that the other students become fearful, and they think that, oh, you know where to get drugs, and, you know, they're afraid of certain communities, and, you know, what do you have a father, and does he work? I mean, it's really that kind of extremity, you know, that these kind of questions that are being posed to him at this time.
Yeah, my son studies lines from Boondocks in order to sound more black. it's so cute and pathetic. but it is that sense of almost living up to the expectations of some of the larger society.
Which is what you had to do as a young black girl, living up to those expectations, to be better, to be smarter, to, you know, play music better, that sort of thing. You described that as well.
Yeah. It's coded differently for him. I think it's in some ways a less safe world for us all, and it may be the subject of a new version of the civil rights movement that we have to really figure out again. It's going to be a much more diverse civil rights movement the next one around, hopefully encompassing all of us. American people who are so hybridized, even those whom we call white, are going to have to get on board this ship.
It's an interesting thought. Melva puts it the same way. We should talk about it more. Mm-hmm. Patricia, I thank you for coming in and spending an hour with us. It's nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much.
Patricia Williams, Columbia University Professor of Law and author of Open House, of Family, Friends, Food, Piano Lessons, and The Search for a Room of My Own. And we didn't even get to talking about the link between Patricia and Oprah Winfrey. That's something you'll have to discover when you get your hands on the book. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.